Hello, is this working? Good. I guess actually one good first question might be just to ask each of our panelists if they have any, it's just in a few minutes, if they have any particular thoughts about what are the main things we should be concerned about thinking about these issues. Should we go down the line? Deirdre?
Start next to you.
Okay, Krishna.
Okay. Off the top of my head, hearing multiple talks today, as well as following some of the work that is being done in this space, I feel like there is a growing community of researchers who are working on these topics of discrimination, fairness. The one concern or one thing that I wish were different is it feels like there are multiple parallel lines of research that are being pursued by different groups, and sometimes the terminology that we use is not always consistent, and sometimes it feels like maybe there is some effort that needs to be put into making sure that we all understand each other's work and compare each other's methods, and so that we have some sort of a consensus that kind of emerges in the community about these topics. Like, for instance, I was calling some notion of discrimination as disparate mistreatment in my work. There was a paper at NIPS conference this year. I think it calls it equal opportunity. I've heard other people use multiple different words, and I feel like there is some work that potentially could be done in terms of like people coming together and understanding these issues in a similar way. But to be fair, this is an emerging topic, so maybe it'll take some time before we get there.
Yeah, great point. So to start with, we need some common language.
Yes.
But I think all of us agree that it's really important just to bring together our different factions to talk about these issues, and hopefully this is part of the start of that movement. Salam.
Thanks. So maybe I'll answer two different ways. So one is sort of about academically, sort of professionally, how do we foster this conversation? And you know, one of my main concerns there is that bridge building is actually quite difficult, in part because despite the, I think, really important efforts of the computer science community to speak to the policy and kind of law and policy community, making the kind of journey across the bridge is generally more difficult, I think, for people to computer science than from computer science to other fields. You know, I think that there's going to be a lot more work that needs to be done to figure out how to make the important work that's already happening in computer science intelligible to people outside the field. And that, I think, relates to the more kind of substantive concern, which is the notions of fairness that are being developed in the computer science literature are often, I think, related to, but sometimes indirectly related to, some of the notions of fairness in the law. And it seems clear to me that a lot more needs to be done to relate the existing enormous amount of thinking that's been done in law and philosophy around these issues to the kinds of work that's being done in computer science, not just to make the work, I think, stronger, but also, I think, for it to then have real policy impact. So my concern there tends to be about if the perceived problem in some cases is the inscrutability of algorithms and the sense that they might be biased, a solution which is equally inscrutable is unlikely to be perceived as a legitimate response to the problem. So there needs to be, I think, some serious efforts made to not only persuade, to help law and policy community understand this work, but to then work with them to make these things actually have some buy-in from a more general audience.
Thank you.
Okay, where to start? maybe this sounds a bit blunt, but I've been working on this for such a long time that that's my problem. Then I have the privilege to work to have a chair in a computer science department with security people, but I have a whole wing of people who do data science. What I see is that this is a very serious science. It's very hard work. It's of course a young science. Opposite me, there are two postdocs that are working on the difference between correlation and causation. They're doing hard work in to figure out how you can find latent causes and check whether they are really causes. Now, when I turn away from my science colleagues to real life, where everybody is trying to get his hands on any big data set that they can find anywhere, which we call low-hanging fruit, and then run algorithms on them and then say, oh, we have these wonderful inferences, and we don't want to ask people consent. European data protection law does not require consent. There are five other legal grounds. And scientific research has a light regime, so if it's about that, that's a different thing. But okay, they say, well, we're not getting this consent, it's all getting very difficult, and then we have to give a purpose. Well, we don't know, we just have this data, and we're going to see the added value that is in it. Now, I think this is pseudoscience, and I couldn't care less if it was playing in the sandbox. But one, we're playing in the sandbox with people's personal data that are often not secured. We're playing in sandboxes where the data set is not secured, so it can be manipulated. We have no idea of the trade-offs that are happening there because it's happening behind trade secrets and IP walls. So it can be highly nonsensical. That's what I meant with the example. If you train an algorithm on animal faces and then show it a plant, it will see animal faces. Now, we all understand that, and we can have a big laugh about it. But there are a lot of things that are happening exactly that way, and nobody sees it because it's much more complex. So I'm very worried that we are making think Internet of Things, think smart grid, on which our electricity supply will come to depend, and all electronics depends on our electricity supply. If we're going to do this sort of bad science, I'm going to be extremely worried. And it's not even about privacy, and it's not even about fairness. It's about methodological rigor and not accepting that to the extent that we're inferring garbage, that nobody can actually check it. Also, of course, thinking about governments, a lot of money is going there. That's not going to other sides. So this is my very serious concern.
So I was going to argue with Deirdre about which end we should start at, because I think probably some of our points have already been talked about. Maybe you have some other good ones. Well, I wanted to sort of pick up on the first point, because I think it was top of mind for all of us. I think the two panels that we witnessed, if for those who were at both panels, didn't just not see points of intersection. I don't think it wasn't just a matter of common language. My concern is that perhaps there's two different sets of ontologies. And here I say that in the metaphysical sense, not in the computer science sense. So I hope that's wrong. And that's something that we'll need to figure out through these kinds of conversations that other people have suggested we're having. But for example, I know that, you know, when I think of colleagues of mine who have dedicated their work for the last 10, 15, 20 years on the topic of substantive equality, I think that their heads would be spinning not from the mathematics of some of the things that they've seen, but again for this idea that some of these things that are discussed algorithmically could stand as proxies for some of the substantive equality issues that they're concerned about. And I'm not really sure how to bridge that conversation, I think it starts with the kind of recognition that we've just partially had around the table. The other one that comes to mind with me is that philosophers will often invoke Immanuel Kant in saying things like, you know, the idea that ought implies can. In other words, we can't say that somebody ought to do something that's impossible. But that technologists are often tempted by the inverse of that, which is that when we can do things, we ought to do them because we can. We can build them. We should build these. We, We can build these things. And so I think that there are some moral tensions, or not moral tensions, but some I'll call them ontological sort of things, and I'm not really sure I have solutions for how to get past that, but I think it's important to see those things if they're there and figure out ways to deal with them, because I otherwise we can talk all we want about translating jargon or sector-specific language, but I'm not sure that that will go the distance.
So I would, I'm going to frame something we've all been talking about. Helen Nissenbaum and I are doing some work together, and we like to talk about conceptual fidelity, right? And part of the, I was talking about there's different concepts of privacy, right? Privacy as secrecy, privacy as limited access to the self, privacy as boundary regulation, privacy as control over information, differential privacy, contextual integrity, right? We have all these different definitions. And those are just ones that I pulled from, you know, a few disciplines. If we look across different disciplines, we have different definitions. And to the extent that we're trying to speak across disciplines, it's important to kind of map and understand the different ways in which we define concepts. But that only gives us like a starting point for having conversations, but I think it would be a really important one. And in the technical presentations I heard today, as Ian was suggesting, there's some assumptions, some kind of taking legal statements in a way that is not completely incorrect, but lacks some of the contextual nuance that's probably important to understand what it really means in practice. And I think it would be really useful to do some of the mapping of what are the definitions of fairness that are being used in this community. In some of the papers that were prepared for the conference, there, whether it's game theory, economics, right, there's a bunch of different stuff going on. It would be really interesting just to map them. I think that would be useful. But going the next step requires us to think in a way that says, if we want to support these concepts, what sort of properties do we need in a system, or what sort of properties do we need in an algorithm? And I think that work is, you know, we see that happening, right? So, oh, it needs to be accountable, or it needs to be this, or it needs, but I think it's not at the level of, like, a property, or, like, you know, what is it that we're actually trying to shoot for here in a way that makes it something that you could, for example, prove, right, and say, you know, my system does exactly that thing. The second is looking at systems that the conversations about, just to take fairness as an example, often are looking at algorithms alone and asking questions about whether they're fair or unfair, and not saying, well, you know, we have this value we care about. We want to protect people against certain kinds of harms. And that there are some ways in which algorithms may be preferable, right? And there are some ways in which legal protections might be preferable. And thinking about how to kind of move the value around or move the risk around, the same way we think about we can't, you know, we're not going to make perfectly secure systems, but we try to move the insecurity around to a place where we can manage it best. And I think that's a concept, like a more systems-oriented concept of thinking about these issues that I think would benefit us, because it makes us think about what different kinds of tools, and machine learning is a tool, and law is a tool, interface design is an approach, right? What different things do well, and what things are kind of, you know, outside their strength. And so I think moving in that direction would also be really beneficial.
Wow, it's a lot to think about. I think that perhaps Deirdre's second set of points about systems may well come up in the second panel after Ben's given his talk. Perhaps I'll try to pull together some of the other themes a little bit. I think we've got a lot of people talking about how can we bridge this divide and try and bring together this technical and legal community to have the same ontology, or to at least try to form some connection between those, as Ian put it. And I think it might be useful to think about two particular concepts that have come up. So one is the notion of fairness. What is fairness? And another is, what is a sufficient explanation? And both of these things are very powerful kind of emotive ideas, which can mean quite different things to different people in different contexts. Would anyone like to perhaps suggest some particular situations and talk about what they mean in a legal concept context and how we might try to define that precisely?
Ask my technical students when there was a lot of concerns about, you know, bias in search engines. And I said, well, you know, what would it mean for a search engine to be unbiased, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. But what is it that people are trying to get at when they're talking about, well, it's, you know, it's not fair or it's biased in ways that are problematic? And they started pulling from things like journalism, right, where there's some desire for objectivity, and then when people decided that objectivity wasn't really obtainable, there was some idea about kind of representation and balance that was important. They started pulling on definitions of fairness tied, you know, to law that are about a fair set of rules and a fair set of processes, right? So transparency, juries, oversight, right? So they started pulling in different frameworks that kind of shed light on when people were complaining about something not being fair, because it isn't just about discrimination, as we've all said, but, you know, what sorts of things were they pulling from? What other reference models might we have? And I found that to be quite useful.
Any particular ones you'd like to give as examples, or? But particular fairness models that people were suggesting?
Those were some.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll say a little bit more about that, and just by responding with a technique that's used commonly in private law. I'm talking about disputes between individual parties, contract law being a paradigm example of that. So sometimes when common law courts are trying to ascertain, for example, what the intentions of the parties are when they're contracting. And it's a slightly different example, but there's a parallel here, which I think you'll see in a moment. So I'm responding in particular to the second part of the question that you were getting at. So the way the question looks online is not only about what is a sufficient explanation, but also what happens when the concerned individual still doesn't get it, right? And so the law has all sorts of mechanisms to deal with that kind of scenario. And in particular, the one I was getting at was this notion that one can apply what the law would call an objective standard. So we're not trying to get, in this case, at whether the individual subjectively gets it and that they are individually somehow satisfied by the explanation. Law doesn't usually require those kind of subjectivities. In intention or in other words. The typical language would be reasonableness, but the important point for purposes here are that those reasonableness standards are determined within a context and then from the perspective of sort of another observer. So in fact, with law, you won't often run into the problem that's motivating that question. And I think what I would say there is there's all sorts of good reasons to hope that we can start to set out what counts as sufficient explanation when we look at it from some kind of more objective reasonableness standard, rather than worrying about whether the particular individual before them, about whom maybe it's a data subject or the decision has been made, that's not really who the audience is. The audience is society at large. So we start to use those kinds of reasonableness models. And although, again, that still sounds like it leaves a lot of vagueness, law has coped very well with that kind of a standard. And in fact, I would flip that around and say it the other way around, which is that standard actually is what makes common law work in its genius, which is to allow for these small incremental changes upon which larger changes ultimately get entrenched and established.
And now the civil law excellence. No. So I will go back to the regulation, because the regulation is seemingly very clear. It basically says if there is an automated decision that has a real significance for your life or legal effect, then you have to know that this is happening, which is already not easy and certainly not complied with at this moment. And the second thing is that you must gain meaningful information about the logic of processing, of profiling, of machine learning. And you must be told about the envisaged consequences of this. And now the question is, of course, always, is it possible to give meaningful information about the processing? I would keep it very simple and say, if that meaningful information is not there, then you are not allowed to make that decision automatically. It's that simple, and I think that's a very good idea. Because if somebody tells me, you have to pay three times more on your health insurance, or you are not getting this job, you're actually not getting the chance to apply for the job, you are rejected automatically in the first encounter, you're not getting in the system, or you're not getting into an educational system, and I can think of a lot of other examples, also in terms of healthcare. Then I want to be able to test how the system got to that conclusion. Because if I can't test that, I can't contest it. And if the person who is benefiting from that decision, in whatever way, a hospital or a government or whatever, the person that is paying to make that decision in such a way, cannot explain how it is taken, then it would be contrary to the rule of law, to human rights, to democracy, to say, well, sorry, that's what my neural network has come to. And my point is not that it is not possible to explain that. I don't believe that at all. Use other data, train other algorithms on the same data set. Learn to play around with it and show that. And of course you can't show that to the data subject because that's not the person who understands it. But under the regulation, the idea is that that the data protection authority should be able to see this, to inspect this. Now, my point is, again, that this also will make the decisions better. If these decisions must be testable to be contestable, they will be much more reliable. And then we're all going to learn. And I like very much what Deirdre Mulligan said, that it's very important to bring the data subjects, the people that are concerned here, the people that are the decisions, that are the target of the decisions, to bring them in, not see them as the enemy that can refuse consent for data, but as the person who is allowed to ask, which data are you processing of me? How does this decision work? It is when this conversation starts, on very practical grounds, if you are refused something that is very important for your life, that's a very practical ground, and you are forced to open up all sorts of black boxes, not by describing exactly what happens, but by doing something else and seeing what is the outcome then. That's much more interesting, also more fun. So I think that's very important, and maybe that is connected with the fact that I don't believe we're going to have a common language. Lawyers have a different language that has different constraints. They have other goals. They should not try to become computer scientists and the other way around. But definitely we must learn to understand what drives us and what are these goals. We must understand much more as lawyers how the methodology of computer science works. And for me, the correlation with the time that the ruler could not read and write and had all these clerks, they were called clerks, who could read and write, and then the people who could not read and write. That monopoly position was at some point, because of the printing press, was broken, and that enabled democracy. And I think if we want to make our entire society dependent on these systems, then we have to learn to understand them. And with we, I now mean people, not just lawyers, but people. Not to the extent that computer scientists understand them, but like ordinary people are supposed to understand the law.
So I think many of us would agree, but I wonder if I could just press on that a little with yes. the lawyers. In particular, we've heard that a company will potentially be hit with a 4% of global revenue fine if they can't provide this meaningful information. And I think that many people in the technical community are a bit confused by that and rather alarmed by it, and they're not sure really. Could you give some examples of what you think would count in court as meaningful information and what would not count as meaningful?
Yes, if we knew that. I think nobody knows that at this moment. And strangely enough, I think that this is exactly what creates the incentive structure for lawyers and technology people to sit down together. It's not the fact that if somebody develops a machine learning system that makes wonderful decisions in the laboratory, that a judge will come and say, naughty boy, now you have to pay 4% of whatever. Maybe you'd have no turnover anyway as a researcher. The point is that if there is an entity that is profiting from these decisions, making money, has a business model on it, that in that case, if that decision significantly affects people and you can't even explain the basis of that decision, yeah, then we come into the realm of fines. But I must honestly say, we would be a strange sort of society to say, well, of course, if the system says that, you'll have to accept it. That's not a society we want. That's unacceptable. So, yes, if you're going to profit, then you're going to be picked in your purse. If you can't explain why I'm not getting into the school that I want to get in. Sorry, that's what the algorithm says. Nobody here would accept that, right?
And I think that does give you, though, a sense of, right, you were talking about the school, right? And you can look at institutions that we expect to provide clarity about their rules. And, you know, some of them we may say, at least in the U.S., the tax code, not a lot of clarity. Right? But the places where we expect to provide clarity and some understanding, not just of kind of what information is considered, but like how it's weighted. Right, how it's considered. So I think there are things to draw from. And one of the papers that was prepared for the symposium today was talking about trading regulations and I believe like tagging of algorithms, different kinds of algorithms that are being used. If you look in the US, there are certain areas where you know you have to be able to explain to regulators not just there's certain data you can't use and certain data you can use, and you have to be able to explain the way in which the data is weighted, right? How things, different things are considered within the algorithm. So I don't, you know, I don't think explainability for many kinds of algorithms is outside of your reach. I think there are some algorithms where it surely is. And I think in those instances, it may be, and I think this is Murrell's point, that they're not fit for purpose, right? That if there was an algorithm that was being used to establish probable cause for a search, and we couldn't explain the basis on which you had been identified, right? On which probably, like, no one would think that was okay, right? And so I don't think that, you know, I think there's plenty of room for progress to be made. I think some of the issues are going to be where there are multiple algorithms and explaining how they interact can become really problematic and complicated. But I think in many instances, I think that there's a path forward and I think it's going to take some work, but I don't think it's undoable.
So regarding this topic of explainability, the thing that worries me is actually not that people cannot come up with, I mean, right now it seems we seem to be predominantly be driven by the fear that there are these very complex algorithms that no one understands. But sooner or later, my worry is actually that people will come up with too many different explanations and we wouldn't know which one to believe in, and that it would end up being like the way politics has become extremely polarized. Like, you take any event, you see the opinion pages of New York Times versus Wall Street Journal, you get two different explanations for the same event. And unless we have some notions of what is a correct explanation and a wrong explanation, we might end up with a mess of explanations. In fact, we already see some of this happening. Even on the papers on fairness, for the same constraint, people are coming up with multiple different motivations and explanations for why they're being done. So I think if we were to foresee a bit into the future, the worry would actually be not that we won't be able to come up with at least one. The worry is that because different, there is this information, different groups of people have different amounts of information and nobody has the full system information. So people will start extrapolating and try to reverse engineer and come up with completely different explanations, and you would end up with a complete mess of a situation where different people believe that the algorithm is doing that for completely different reasons. And that's the thing that actually worries me more and makes me feel like we should be more careful about, instead of thinking about meaning, much more than meaningful, we should have notions of correct and wrong explanations.
So we get explanation obesitas also after all the other obesitas, and I think the one generates the other. So one of the explanations that was given for the rise of populism is that people are continuously reading that scientists have researched something and they found A, and so they all do A, like they eat nuts, good for their brains, and then 3 days later, scientists have discovered that it gives you a specific type of cancer if you eat four of them every evening with some other constraints. And they say, we don't want to know anymore what scientists say. It's all nonsense. They speak against each other. Now, that's very interesting because that is in itself not something that you can resolved by then saying, I'm now going to force one vocabulary on everybody, and if people go outside that vocabulary, we don't listen to it anymore. So this is the kind of society that we have generated, and the more we train, the more algorithms on the more data sets, the more inferences we are going to get. And the question is, which of these inferences are interesting, relevant, reliable? What does reliable mean here? We've talked about fairness, but you can ask all these questions and get very different answers for the reliability, the relevance, etc. So for me, this is a learning process that we will all have to share, that if we keep on collecting more data and running more algorithms on it, we're going to be stuck with this total confusion. And the clever people who know how to put a business model on what inferences are going to win out. And that's not necessarily, there I totally agree with you, what is relevant and what is important and what correlates with the world outside the data set. Now, I would say that lawyers are actually very much used to this sort of ambiguity. And I dare say that lawyers are very pragmatic people. So they say, what is the value, what is behind this legal rule? And they can't then say, well, I personally think this or that, or my morality or religion says this or that. No, there is a whole system that is kept in check, that is has evolved historically, that goes between the legislator and the courts. If the courts go too far, the legislator comes back. And this will take time to make these sort of decisions and to say, okay, if decisions with this kind of impact on somebody's life cannot be explained in a way that indeed it's not only a matter of whether this particular person can understand it, but that experts agree gives a reasonable explanation, then these sort of decisions cannot be delegated to these systems.
I know Ian's dying to say something, and then Solon wants to say something, and then after that we'll pause for a break. Well, not so much for a break, but an exciting interlude where we'll hear another talk, and then we'll come back for more panel discussion.
Sure. So I'll try to be a bit provocative. So I think, you know, one of the things that motivates people who work in machine learning is a general sense that there can be very difficult problems that could be addressed using learning methods that might not be possible to address using standard programming approaches. And what that suggests is that there might be policy goals, like, you know, policy goals that I imagine many of us on this panel would agree with, that would be best served by methods that would actually then generate models that are hard to explain. Right? So at least we should acknowledge that there are tensions here which are not so straightforward. Right? That we may actually be trading off some value for explanations against the possibility of producing highly accurate models, even in situations that there might be significant consequences for people. Right? And my general worry here, too, is that for perhaps some historical reasons, we imagine that a narrative that comports with human categories, with human notions of causality, is a good basis for deciding whether or not something is reliable. And I submit that maybe some of the things that machine learning excels at are actually difficult things to model, things that cannot be modeled parsimoniously. And therefore, there's actually going to be genuine trade-offs between trying to effectively model some kind of thing and the ability to furnish explanations that comport with human categories of knowledge. Right? That, to me, is a genuinely difficult problem, but we shouldn't pretend that the, I think, very valid concerns that motivate a call for explanation aren't in tension with other things that we would also want to achieve. And let me just point out, too, that interestingly, the work that's been done on interpretability and machine learning actually, I think, speaks very nicely to some of the ambiguity about what we even ask for when we ask for explanations in law and policy. Right? So, for instance, in interpretability and machine learning, some people work on the interpretability of the model itself. You want to be able to actually see what has been learned. Right? That's very different than providing an explanation for a particular inference. So this work that people saw on QII, right? That's producing explanations, but that's not necessarily telling you how the model itself operates altogether, right? And the question there is, different approaches to interpretability and machine learning are going to be addressing different normative concerns from the policy world. And we need to be much clearer about the kinds of explanations we want when we even ask for those explanations. And the very final thing I'll say is that, you know, I imagine you could even satisfy the call for an explanation of what the rule is. Tell me what the rule is, okay? So imagine someone tells you what the rule is, and you're like, yeah, okay, I see that, but like, what I really want to know is, why is this the rule? So that's actually a very different question, right? You can satisfy the demand for a description of the rule, but it can absolutely have no, not that it would be unintelligible, rather, you don't understand why the rule looks that way. And if someone were to ask why, the most likely answer would be, across multiple statistical dimensions, you resemble this person or these people who tend to behave this way. So we're going to impute to you the qualities possessed by people who happen to be statistically similar. And is that a satisfying answer? It's a true answer, right? But I don't know if that actually gets us to the normative goals that underlie the call for explanation. So I just want to ask for us to actually think about how a lot of the excellent work that's been done in interpretability and machine learning can force greater precision in the law and policy debate.
Sure.
I do want to say I completely agree with everything that you said, Solana. And in fact, I think one of the values that we get in what working across is greater precision. Because if you want to build something into a technical system, you can't leave the fights for later. And lawyers, we like to do that, right? It's actually part of the art. It's not an accident. It's not a bug. It's a feature, right? We want to litigate later. We leave lots of room for the evolution of new things, right? But I do want to say that while I think it is true that there will be places where we have tension between interpretability and other substantive goals, there are instances where we're going to have greater tolerance and less tolerance for a lack of interpretability, right? So in some instances, it may be the first order goal, and I think many of the areas where we're getting complaints about it, that is the problem.
Yeah. Great. Thanks very much. So we're now going to turn over to Ben Allery, who's going to give us a exciting possible vision for the future.
Okay. Thanks, Adrian. So I think one of the things that I've taken away from a lot of the conversation today so far is that people have a really high estimation of how good humans are at regulation. So people think, so humans are like perfect at regulating, and machines are apt to be terrible and apt to discriminate in statistically very worrisome ways. And it kind of, that conflicts very much with my own personal experience as a lawyer, as a legal academic for the last two decades. and conflicts a lot with our experience. And when I say our experience, I mean my experience with my two colleagues, Albert Yoon and Anthony Niblett, who are sitting over here in the front row, and using machine learning to predict legal outcomes. So let me step you through what we've been doing, what this is all about, and why we think regulation by machines isn't as absurd as I think some of you suspect it is. Okay, so much of the literature assumes that you know we should be worried about how to regulate these machines, and these are serious concerns, right? Yes, we should be worrying about how to regulate autonomous vehicles. We should be investigating whether you know certain algorithms are discriminatory in important contexts. We should be worried about privacy concerns surrounding the use of big data. We ask, how can we use artificial intelligence to essentially create better laws and regulations for human activity? So we kind of say, well, let's flip this on its head. How can we actually use machine learning to make things better? First, and we're very confident about this first claim, we think we can streamline the administration of law by predicting court outcomes, and I'll show you an example of that. And second, algorithms by degrees will tend to become the law. And it's going to be an interactive process with the courts, with human judges, but you'll see through the example, I think, an illustration of how this can happen. Okay, so first of all, to motivate this, humans are not infallible. Humans are not perfect. If you call the Canada Revenue Agency, we happen to be Canadian. If you call the Canadian Revenue Agency and ask a question, they give bad tax advice. So an independent audit of the Canada Revenue Agency, and we have a self-assessment tax system. So you're meant to call up and get advice about how to comply with tax law. They give, you know, routinely, you know, 25% erroneous advice in these call centers. That's not a great outcome. That's human-led regulation, right? 25% poor answers. We know that humans can be beat by algorithms. This is Billy Bean. That's Brad Pitt playing Billy Bean. Billy Bean, of course, is responsible for the ascendance of the Oakland Athletics using, you know, algorithms and you know, statistics to improve the performance of the Oakland Athletics. Algorithms can outperform humans in all sorts of different contexts, and we can use machine learning technology to improve the law. More specifically, we can use it to predict court outcomes. And it's really important in areas, in gray areas of law, where you have these ill-defined standards. You have multi-dimensional classification problems that humans really find it hard to predict the outcomes of. But these are like kind of perfectly designed for machine learning algorithms to uncover the hidden patterns. And this you would have seen this quote if you were here earlier this afternoon, and Ian had this quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes. Essentially, the idea is the law is what you predict it to be. If you can predict the outcome of the courts, that's what's meant by law. And, you know, it's all going to be ultimately about economics and statistics and prediction. Okay, so this is gray. As we increase the density here, we start to get some resolution. That's what we aim to make the law into, right? It comes out to being black and white. And we can expose these gray areas of law and make it clearer. And I'll show you an example. So let's suppose you're a tax lawyer, your client's a massage therapist. She works at a clinic, and she wants to know whether she's an independent contractor or an employee for tax purposes. It's very, very difficult to figure out the answer, and it has really big tax consequences for individuals like your client. Now, the usual way to answer this question would be to do some research or maybe ask for an advanced tax ruling. If you ask for an advanced tax ruling, it'll cost you a $2,500 deposit. The normal response time is 18 weeks from the Canada Revenue Agency. It may cost you more. It may take more time. That's in the ideal state. Or you could do research online and read hundreds of cases to become fully apprised of what's going on. The leading case is a case called Weed Door from 1986. You could look to there. You'd find it turns on a total relationship test, and it looks to a bunch of different factors. So the contract, control, ownership of tools, risk, integration, other things. So you could do that, and then you could reason about by analogy to your client situation and try to come up with an answer. It happens all the time. It gets litigated all the time. More than 600 cases. You couldn't read all those cases and give an adequate answer to your client. But for us, it's great because we can use those cases to teach a machine learning algorithm. That's what we're doing at BlueJay Legal. So we can consistently and accurately predict out of sample cases more than 90%, well over 90% of the predictions are accurate in out of sample testing. And rather than spending hours researching this stuff, you can just use our system and get an answer very, very quickly. So let's return to our client's case. All you need to do is fill out a series of questions, inform the system about the background facts. I'm not going to take you through all of these things. I'm going to click through very quickly, skip a few, and we'll get to the compute button. When I click compute, what the system does is it compares the facts that it just gathered from you. It's going to compare it to all the existing cases that have been decided, gives us a prediction, employee 89% accurate. It also provides automatically generated explanation about why that's the outcome, articulated in the terms of the legal test, the total relationship test developed by the courts in hundreds and hundreds of cases. So you can read that. Then I don't know, the panel will have to tell me whether or not that satisfies the demand for explanation or not. I mean, it's kind of what a judge would write if a judge were deciding the case. Now, let's suppose the clinic disagrees with that entry of facts. They may say, well, we would have answered some of those questions differently. That's not exactly right. So we can go back and change some of those answers and recompute. Oh, it's still employee. So those are not pivotal facts that change. Okay, so now it seems on either version of the facts, the case would go the same way. We get another explanation that's consistent with the other one. And this is a case that should never have been to court. Right? And there are tons and tons of cases like this in the jurisprudence. Cases get litigated that are kind of overdetermined on the basis of their facts. And it means that the law is slower to develop than it otherwise would be because the courts are busy deciding these questions that individuals really want to litigate because they're viewing their facts through their own lenses. They're subject to their own confirmation biases. So let's see, how does this become law, right? So this is the... If you go for an advanced tax ruling, that's what happens. What if the Canada Revenue Agency comes up with an app using BlueJay Legal technology? You could just submit your facts, you get an outcome, you're an employee, you get an answer within seconds at very low cost, and over time, the algorithm will tend to become the law, right? So at first, we just use this to provide information to regulators. Regulators can log into our system, get an answer provided over the phone. They'll do better than 75% correct. And then they get the algorithm gets feedback, the system gets better over time, and then the government's happy enough with the predictions that they provide it just on their website. Who wants to pay $25 to have a call center person enter this information and then read back the answer to the user? Let's just expose it on our website. And then ultimately it kind of becomes the law, because that's the answer. That's the regulated answer. That is the law. And so we think this is more fair, more equal than human-led regulation. Why should your tax liability depend on which human regulator answers the phone in the call center? And in fact, there are lots of tax lawyers who call multiple times. They sample the call center, and then when they get the answer they want, they say, okay, can you tell me what your name is again? I'm going to write down the time that I called, and they include that in the client letter. It's terrible. Human regulators are inconsistent, resource-constrained, effort-avoiding. These algorithms can improve the law. They're more consistent, less resource-constrained, and the law is noble ex ante. It truly is the realization of the principles of the rule of law using this kind of system. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ben. Lots. Yes, if the panel could come back up, that would be great. Lots to discuss there, I think. So I'm Neil Lawrence. I'm at the University of Sheffield and at, on leave of absence at Amazon. I'm going to moderate this next session. I don't like the fact that the lawyers are at one end of the table and the computer scientists at the other. Can we mix it up a little bit? Come on, Mireille, come on, move down here. Come on, let's have some mixing at least. Yeah, come on, otherwise it gives the wrong impression. That was a great starting point. So, Ian, can we replace you with a computer?
Nope.
And why not? I mean, I think what's fascinating here is that there's two professions amongst us, and the role of both professions is to codify things. But the way in which we want to codify those things is quite different. So one of us is trying to codify things so precisely that we can get a computer to recreate it, and the other group of us is saying, oh, but it's nuanced. So here's the code, but there's a nuance, and you have to understand there's interpretation. So this seems to be about bridging that gap, Ian. So why is that hard, and how can we address it?
Sure. Well, so first of all, the idea that the algorithm somehow over time becomes the law is precisely the self-fulfilling prophecy notion that I was talking about earlier. But coming back to your question, so I'm trying to think of which things I want to say. I'll start with just mentioning something, shameless self-promotion.
If you've got a choice, then.
That's right, exactly. No, a couple of years ago, in all seriousness, I wrote a paper co-authored with a constitutional lawyer by the name of Chris Imamathan, and the paper is called Chief Justice John Roberts is a Robot. And the paper imagines an interesting counterfactual, which is that Justice Roberts is at a judicial event in Europe. Something bad happens. They have to cut him open. They cut him open, and lo and behold, they find he's a robot. The question then asked is, what does that say about the Roberts Court jurisprudence? In sort of going through this counterfactual and thinking about this, it lends a situation by which we can evaluate some of the questions that I think you've just provoked and the paper provokes as well. And so one of the issues that we look at along the way is this question of whether, as per the U.S. Constitution, whether Chief Justice Roberts the robot can swear an oath. Okay? Because in order to be a judge in the U.S., you have to swear an oath. And so in going through this sort of example, we can talk about the idea of the robot performing a kind of mimesis of going through the action of swearing an oath. And what that tells us is that there is, on the one hand, the idea of following a rule, rule-following behavior, following the rule versus rule-following behavior. And they look a lot alike. But I would suggest that it's not merely a matter of nuance in terms of the way, for example, a judge applies the rules, because I think machine learning could do the equivalent of that. I think the problem ultimately is that this is not just a kind of functionalist reduction, a reduction to function in a kind of way. And so, for example, participating in an oath is part of a social practice. And it's part of a social practice that has meaning inside of a culture. And this is something that Wittgenstein and others were onto before. And so I think, just with that as one kind of an example, that what happens is you can't simply reduce the meaning to the outcome in a kind of way, because there's a lot more going on there. And it's not nuance of the application of the rule. It's an entire set of social and cultural practices that is being displaced by something else. Could we decide that we want to do that and that might be better for society? Absolutely. But it's not the same thing.
Okay, so I'll put this to Krishna. So I've been jailed because Judge Biggins hadn't had a good lunch, and he gave me 10 years rather than 6. And then I explained to the guy who's going to prison, well, because of social practice, you're going to have to go to prison for 10 years rather than 6. So Krishna, surely it's machine learning to the rescue. We're going to get consistent decision making, and we can approximate all this, surely.
So, I mean, given my lack of background in social sciences, I would be hesitant to make any strong claims. But I have to admit, I sometimes do not. I guess I come from. I come from this position that at the end of the day, what machine learning algorithms can do is information processing, right? Now, maybe this is taking it too abstract, but as long as you believe that humans are also doing information processing, it's quite possible that today none of the machine learning models are anywhere close to the sort of complex information processing human brain could do. But if you were to look at it from an abstract perspective, if what machines are doing is information processing and what humans are doing is information processing, at some point in the future, we should be able to get to a point, hopefully we'll get to a point where maybe not in the near-term future, but we would eventually get there. So I start with that kind of like a very abstract perspective of like, and so I tend to believe that even if we are not able to, some of these things, like when we say certain things like humans can understand the meaning of an explanation or things like that, I feel like eventually these things would be mapped in the way long term. Like now I'm not talking in terms of like 5 years or 10 years, maybe several decades from now. Eventually all these concepts, I feel, would eventually be mapped to some sort of information processing. In fact, one of the things that I find fascinating is I was reading some paper by, I believe it was by Simon, Herbert Simon, a long time ago, where he talks about explaining human behavior by modeling in a computational way the human behavior. And it's kind of fascinating that today we talk about like explaining machine decision making, when not so long ago it was thought that the way you would explain human behavior is if you could actually build a computational model that would actually perform things in a similar way as a human would.
Could I jump in?
Yeah, sure. Deirdre, go ahead, yeah.
So the idea that the goal of the judicial system is to make sure that the rules are applied exactly the same way over time misunderstands the role of the judicial system, right? That what it's, think about decisions like Plessy v. Ferguson, which was separate but equal was okay, or decisions that homosexual couples didn't have a right to privacy, right? That the law is decided over time on the basis of specific facts, in part because we understand the context in which the law is being applied, not just the facts before it, but our understandings of what is just actually evolve over time, right? And so to give a tiny little example, many of you probably remember discussions about whether or not we could formalize and codify the concept of fair use in copyright law. Here you have fair dealing in the UK, right? But the instances where I can use a copyrighted work without in advance getting permission from the rights holder, right? And many people in the technical community said, well, look, we can just kind of articulate all the things that it's been determined that people are allowed to do, right? So for example, you could record things off the TV so that you could time shift, right? And that would have ended up being codified, right? Your ability to time shift maybe, but maybe not your ability to format shift, right? Or some of the abilities that you probably take for granted today to do all sorts of things with copyrighted works, that because we have a system that doesn't make ex ante decisions about how the law applies to your set of facts, but actually wants you to come in and argue about it so that our understandings of what the law allows evolve over time in relationship to both visions of justice as well as new technical capabilities and norms that evolve in that space. And how many of you have ever gone to court? And did you go because you knew you were going to win, or did you go because you were really pissed off and you wanted your day in court and you wanted to argue and you wanted to change the law? Any of you wanted to change the law? I guess maybe that's just me, right? But that, as Ian was saying, when we think about kind of the privatization of decision making through technical systems, it loses, somebody mentioned Roger Brown's word, right, some of the moral register, right, that we don't have the witnessing of the community. It becomes this private act rather than a public act. It precludes public battles about government objectives, right, that those things happen in courts of law. They don't happen when a bot spits out a, this is how all the cases before you have been decided. And so that it's really important to understand that the algorithm, right, and we can think about the legal decision as an algorithmic system, is both performative as well as focused on an output.
So that strikes me a little bit as
a bit unfair because you didn't explain how the judge comes to the balanced system. And these questions of fairness and unfairness, I don't actually have much credit that judges know how they're making them in the base case. So you've talked about a codified system and saying, well, you can't just put the codes in. But in some sense, I think the point was it's learning from data. They didn't say it wasn't going to evolve or it couldn't evolve. It was trying to summarize an average opinion which would be consistent. I don't want to talk too much because I'm not on the panel, but I'm just trying to bring the argument back in a bit that I think I would agree with everything personally you would say, but I don't know, maybe we should have Solon nerd, so we're iterating between the technical and the... Or Mireille, you...
No, you should go ahead.
Yeah, go.
I want to hear what you have to say, so...
He wants the advantage of hearing you speak first.
He does his algorithms. Yeah, there's too much to say, of course, but... for me, there's a difference between law, discipline, and public administration. So if you have a very complicated rule set, like, for instance, in the financial world, they have found that if you can translate it into modules of blockchain, you can make it sort of self-executing, and these systems can understand, calculate very complex rule systems like they are out there now, and help companies to comply if they want. Now, for me, that's not law. That's maybe it's public administration. You take a set of decisions. In this case, it's advice, for instance, right? Or it's discipline. There's a famous philosopher called Hegel, and he wrote a book called Philosophy of Law. And in that, he talks about punishment. And he talks about punishment, and he says there is this other philosopher, Feuerbach, who said, let's be very clever. If somebody commits a crime and has a benefit out of that, the only thing we have to figure out is the size of the benefit, and then we think of a punishment that we give to that guy which is slightly bigger, and then he won't commit any crimes. That was called, naive of course we would say now, but that was called the teaching of the psychological force. And Hegel said that's like having a stick and training your dog to do something or not to do something. He said punishment is appealing to a person's reason and saying, look, we're a democracy. We have said that this is not allowed. You have done it. We have agreed that this is such a serious violation, blah, blah, etc. Now, to me, law is something entirely different than having a self-executing code, because the system that you describe, the end of that is, of course, that we don't need any lawyers anymore if the systems are good enough. That means they're going to, and I think this moment is already coming very soon with the big law firms, they're going to be training their algorithms on decisions made by the other algorithms. Now, I don't know if you ever have to fill in that sort of list where you have, like, three choices. The first choice is not your situation, the second one also not, and the third one also not. But alas, there is nothing else. And then you call the help desk. This happens very often with telecom operators, government institutions. Then you call the help desk and you say, well, my situation doesn't fit in the box. And then they say, that's not possible. Well, it's not possible, but it's true. They say, well, sorry, you have to pick one, and then it will be all right. Maybe human taxation advice, if you call the taxation office in the Netherlands, I think is far more wrong than in Canada. I would say 67% of the advice is totally wrong. But does that mean we now have to give ourselves over to these sort of tick boxes? So I would say yes. If it's a support machine, if it's a way to make things simpler, but please don't call it law. Law is for when you want to contest this and say, look, I've now tried to fill this thing in, and every time I get another answer, but this is not my situation. Then you go to law, then you go to court, because you disagree. And then you give an example of the judge that didn't eat very well and then sentenced somebody to something. You can go to a higher court. So there are some mitigations for that. But it's a different thing from what these machines do. They are simulating. And for the time being, they're simulating us. And what I'm concerned about is if we don't get it right, if we think that that is law, they're going to simulate each other. And I really think that is not a good idea.
I think, okay, so this session I should have explained is on the longer term issues. And I think Krishna's point, and we're going to come back into Solon in a moment, but I just want to, where I think there's a bit of a gap with what Krishna was saying, what's been answered. Krishna's sort of saying, well, we're just information processing systems. So in the end, there's nothing you can't replicate about us. I provoked Ian just a little bit there, apparently. But let me bring Solon in there, just, and then we'll come across to Ian in a response to that. Because I just think, you know, that this thing of what the law is today and what its function is today, in the long term, maybe that's, I mean, why do we have the law? How does it come about? In some sense, we shouldn't just defend our professions for what they are. We should realize what the function is in society, and that in the long term, that will evolve. And I really think Krishna's point's a good one, that we are just information processing. But anyway, Solon.
I'll make a very slight point, which is that in actually some of this work on fairness and even some of the work on accountability in machine learning, what's been very interesting is the expectation that the policy or legal world will furnish some kind of definition that can then be instantiated or made a constraint into the learning process. And I think what this fails to reflect is that oftentimes policy is the result of political compromise, where specificity or precision is purposefully lacking in order to achieve policymaking, right? So if you had to actually elaborate completely what the rule is, it's very likely that in many situations you would not be able to build the coalition necessary to get anything passed. And so in a way, you might have an argument, a legal philosophy argument about the problems with that as well, but I think it's worth at least for the moment to recognize that oftentimes the lack of specificity or precision that is such a problem to translating things into these technical procedures is not an accident, right? It's often purposeful, and that we often rely on the courts, I think, to be able to provide a venue for that precision and specificity to be argued out in particular cases. So I don't want to see it as just a failing, but actually a purposeful function of how these systems work.
So I don't disagree with anything that you just said, just as I didn't in your last intervention. But I do say that there's a difference between the kind of argument you're trying to put forward as opposed to the provocation that Neil, and I think also in Ben's paper, was trying to be put forward. And let me shine the light back in the other direction, if I may. So now we've got a machine learning system, which is just another information processor working in its own ways. And let's say, for example, maybe even having a better success rate than the courts do. And there's all sorts of reasons from an efficacy perspective and a utilitarian perspective to adopt it, whether we call it law or not. And we can even leave that question aside. So now I want to bring into the mix Paul the Octopus. 2010... Paul the Octopus was outstanding. In 2010, had a better prediction rate than any of the Vegas odds makers and all of their algorithms and statisticians at predicting World Cup outcomes. And so if we're going to base this on two thresholds, one, it's an information processing system, and two, it has a better efficacy or track record than the others, then I think that we'd be subject to the same argument, which would say that in that situation, we should be using Paul the Octopus instead of the machine learning system. So I don't even need a response from you because I already know what the response is. And I think what I'm trying to point out by way of the example is to say that I think part of what's going on here actually comes back to the discussion on the first panel, which is we're holding on to certain things that are dear to us in terms of fundamental precepts to our disciplines. And I think that's at least in part of what's going on. All I've tried to argue so far is to say that I don't feel that mere functional equivalence is such that we can reduce law to these other information systems.
So I think that's a nice example. It's sort of one that would resonate with people. I mean, if Paul the Octopus is right, then we should use Paul the Octopus. But then I think that there's something missing from our discussions. It would resonate with people.
In law courts?
No, not in law courts. But one of the things we've been missing in our discussions is how you explain what the hell's going on to real people. And there were a couple of questions about that in terms of what does privacy mean to real people, and in terms in the things we've been asked to discuss. And in particular, I think that a lot of our discussions around here, they're totally not directed at the people that are going to suffer the consequences of these actions. And in a democracy, in our societies, we believe that people should be engaged in this process. So if people are going to accept these decisions that we're making about how we use machine learning or how we use people, do we not have to rephrase it in terms that they can understand, rather than this is what law does, this is what law has done for years, this is how we judge things in machine learning, and these are the precision of this. I'll perhaps come bring Krishna in there just to restart again. Yeah? Or maybe not. You'll go after. Maybe, Solon, do you want to go on that? Or Ian, you, or Deirdre?
I just want to ask a clarifying question, because I think I understood, but I want to make sure.
Yeah.
So you're imagining that people might eventually demand that certain decisions be made through these automated procedures, in part because they probably rightfully perceive that some decisions are made in biased ways. And then how would you respond to, well, sorry.
I imagine that in society there could be a situation where the wider population perceives that there's a metropolitan elite that's making decisions on their behalf, and they get rather angry about this. And this could bring about rather dangerous situations which destabilize the whole of society. And the best way of dealing with this is to ensure that we explain very well to people how these decisions are being made. And most of the discussion I think we've had so far would not resonate with people in that way, and how can we address that?
So I think, you know, there's this question about whether, right, to the extent that we can provide people with easy, fast, the example that Ian opened up with of the chatbot helping people with parking tickets, right? There's kind of finite bodies of law. These are kind of low-stakes issues. Some of you, well, yeah, there's a thing in the U.S. called NOLO Press that provides kind of self-help legal guides, right, and forms and things that people can help. It makes the law very easy to understand. It is particularly aimed at areas where, you know, the cost of actually fighting something is just really not worth it, right? And so it's not that there aren't areas where there are kind of dense rules that might be really easy to subject to automation, and it might be both efficient, a better use of scarce public resources, right? The amount of time dealing with kind of mundane issues means that other things aren't going on. And in some instances, to the extent that we're concerned about the judge who had a crappy lunch or doesn't like the color of your skin, rule out some of those sorts of variables if we can rule them out of the underlying data on which it's trained, right? Which would be a question. I'm actually wondering whether or not you've looked at the identity of the people behind the cases, because it's usually not in the case law, right? If we think about the whole conversation we've had about understanding your data and the biases that might be hidden in your data, typically when you look at a court case, it doesn't tell you anything. It tells you, you know, the plaintiff came in, they were injured, not it's a white female in her 50s, or like that's not the sort of stuff that you find in there. So to the extent that we assume that there were a lot of people who didn't like the lunch they had and didn't like the color of people's skin historically, it's not as though they're not in the data that you're training the system on, right? And it's not there to tease it out because we don't actually capture those things. But assuming that we could create a set of rules that we felt we could fairly apply, and if we asked the right set of questions, I think there are certain areas of as Muriel was saying, kind of administrative decision making that it would probably be really beneficial for us to provide on a more self-servicey sort of way. But the question of kind of, you know, Ian was saying that we're defending our profession. You know, I don't practice law in the way most of my profession does, and neither does Ian. And I actually am defending the role of the rule of law, right, which is a concept with a very long tradition that, for me, you know, is more about justice than about my profession. And justice being something that is about witnessing and communities coming together and public decision making, something that should evolve over time. And you know, it is a very also kind of US-based argumentative tradition, right? But it's not purely about profession, but it is about process, not just about outcome.
I'm just thinking, so the one thing that I'm picking up, though it might, I might be mistaken here, is that granted, there are some huge concerns with the fact that if your training data is biased or a variety of biases in the training data might end up affecting the decisions that a learning system would make. But learning systems are not just mimicking decisions, or when you're learning, you don't necessarily need to always mimic the decisions that were made in the past, right? You could even set up some sort of like an objective function for which you could compute what would be the right decision to make. And sometimes those computations may not be possible by human because you just have too many different alternatives that you have to go through to find what would be the right decision, even if you agreed that that would be the right decision. And so there may be, I mean, I think one thing that we didn't seem to cover or mention is there may be certain situations where, independently of the biases of human judgment, machine decisions might be better if you actually knew what the objective of the decision was and if you found a way of formally or mathematically specifying what that objective is. So there may be some specific scenarios where actually human judges, just because at the end of the day, when you're making decisions, you have to compute over all the information, and you just cannot do it. I don't know if that makes any sense. It might be a too abstract a point.
Of course, I'm going to disagree. I think there's...
You disagree. There's no situations where that's true.
Sorry?
So you said there may be situations. I think he wasn't saying it's always the case, but there may be occasions when...
There will be
situations. Yes, okay. So I must clarify what I don't agree with. The reason that I was triggered is that you say that computers are better at computing than we are. I totally agree with that. I think that's absolutely obvious. That's one thing that computers are better at than us. But now the question is whether our mind is a matter of computation. And that goes back to the earlier question, whether we are information processing beings. So if you look into the history of science, you see that we talk about ourselves in terms of the sort of things that we have invented. There are a lot of words, terms, like extracting something from a paper, which refers to chemistry. And we are now in the era where we begin to mirror what we do in terms of computer science. That's understandable, but that doesn't mean that we are computers. So there is a difference between information and meaning. Like a system that has no self-consciousness. I'm not even talking about consciousness. My cat has consciousness, but it doesn't have self-consciousness. It doesn't think in terms of language like we do about itself. That's a difference. Now, computers at this moment, and I wouldn't want to exclude that at some point they develop consciousness or self-consciousness. I wouldn't exclude it, but it probably won't be something that we can recognize because they are distributed, they're polymorphous, and they're mobile. So we are used to thinking that people are within their skin bag, as some philosophers say, and computers are not in their skin bag. Now, we can suffer, and we can sort of empathize. Computers can simulate that, no problem. And if somebody cannot see the difference between simulating that and experiencing it, then the conversation becomes really difficult.
So I know Ian wants to come in, and I think what we'll do is have a little, we've got about 5 minutes left, so if you just want to say your thoughts on, follow up on that point, and then perhaps end with a final thought, and then we'll just bob around with final thoughts from everyone, yeah?
Sure, my follow-on was on the point before, starting with the recognition that, of course, there are certain kinds of predictions and decisions making that machines can do better than people. I don't think that's, hugely contentious. The question is, what we draw from that as a conclusion from that. So there are some people, for example, who and I think there was some of this in the presentation that we saw, that start from a position of recognition of human failings and human vulnerability, and then recognize that in some cases machines aren't subject to those same failings and vulnerability. The context in which I know that best is the work of Ronald Arkin, who works on the subject of lethal autonomous weapons. And he actually has this view that of a concept he's developed called the ethical governor, and he sort of thinks that we'll get to the point, not too far, where machines are actually better at comporting with international humanitarian law. They don't have a revenge motive. They don't, tired to the point of exhaustion. They're not subject to the fog of war and all these kinds of things. So I'm willing to recognize, even although I don't like the cynical start from the idea that humans are inferior to machines, if you're drawing a more general inference, but I don't think that's what you were doing. But from that point, I would still want to say that even if we're all in agreement that a machine might be better at making a certain kind of decision, it doesn't necessarily mean we want to delegate those decisions. To me, the lethal autonomous weapons is a perfect example of that. I think there's a fundamental moral line about killing, and that we wouldn't delegate the machine to that. I think my students are very sympathetic to the Ronald Arkin kind of argument in the context of grading programs, student grading programs, right? Doesn't suffer from exhaustion, doesn't have bias, you know, all of those kind of things. But to me, again, that wouldn't be a place where, even if the machine system was way more consistent, where I would be inclined to want to use it. And that's because I think that writing has a particular cultural purpose, and one writes for an audience. And so one might say that even if the machine system is more convenient and consistent, we still might not say that in every case where that is so, that we would want to therefore delegate to the machine. That would be my point of view.
Great. So maybe if we just go through and summarize final thoughts, and I don't know, perhaps if everyone has something that maybe they've learned today, if they've learned anything, or something perhaps for going forward, because I don't think we've resolved everything quite yet. That might be a good way of trying to do it. Anyone like to start who already has those things in mind? Deirdre? You didn't sort of say yes, but no one did. So.
Sure. So I do think kind of the conversation about the conditions under which one might take a set of rules that have normally been operationalized by lawyers and move them over to a machine learning platform gives us a really interesting way to think about a broader area of values in design, right? And it was clear from the presentation that the idea that machine learning was preferable in this context was because it was going to optimize around a set of values, right? And I think what we did was say there are some other values that are part of decision making by lawyers that you might not view as the primary value, right? But depending upon where you are situated or your experience of the law or how you look at kind of the role of law in society, might be quite compelling and important. And you would not only want to think about, again, going back to my voting example, how it transfers that primary function and kind of the functional fidelity, do we get good results, whatever we think, but also how it impacts all those secondary values, because those are important too. And in switching between, right, or delegating things to machines, paying attention to the way in which it impacts things that might not be the exact task that you're trying to move over are really important.
So I've had a lot of opportunity to speak, and if, with the permission of the chair, I'd actually cede my opportunity to Ben and or his author team, because they sort of started this conversation and haven't really had a chance to respond to some of the things we've said, and I think you still have a mic, but if you're interested, I'd give my time, or else we can go to Sal.
So let's see. I think the one point I would say, and it's my overall response, is I've kind of seen, I'm witnessing the minds kind of changing a little bit from when you first, you know, sat back up here. I think the conversation has kind of moved a long way towards, you know, conceding that maybe there are some moments at which this makes a lot of sense. And there would be pockets, you know, where machines are going to be better than human decision makers. And I think our model isn't that we see machine learning immediately supplanting humans, right? So you'd still keep the same apparatus of appeals and you'd have recourse to lawyers, but it's a much easier way to get legal answers very, very quickly, much more consistently and reliably. And over time, it's going to grow kind of, you know, ironically, organically, right, in the system. This inorganic way of coming up with decisions is going to grow by degrees over time and colonize more and more of the legal system. So I think that would be my response. And it's meant to be, you know, planting seeds now, right, and letting them grow and seeing where it takes us and seeing how the legal system evolves.
Did you want to?
Well, I said I'd cede my time, so let it. I have lots to say.
You know, the final thing I'll just say is that it's worth noting the rather enormous controversy that has already cropped up around the introduction of machine learning-based tools in the justice system. And so, you know, the past year has been largely an ongoing discussion about the use of recidivism prediction. And, you know, there is especially a case where you might say, let's really try to improve the accuracy of those predictions because this is a matter of liberty, right? And there as well, there's been, I think, very important work that's been done. There's been enormous debate that's been sparked that's, I think, very meaningful for this community. And what I think it showcases is that rather than providing an obvious opportunity to bring greater consistency, what it's actually done is reveal somewhat unresolved tensions in the normative goals that animate a lot of basic parts of the justice system. So to me, this is actually an interesting outcome. It suggests that rather than this being a process that can be necessarily improved automatically by the introduction of machine learning, the introduction of machine learning can actually force important normative debates that might not be easily resolved, but are actually worth having debated.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I actually, you talked about the essay grading computer systems. So MIT and Harvard and another one started the MOOCs, and at the same time they started this. And the guy, he's written a wonderful blog on this, and he he explains very wonderfully that if you want to train the algorithm to grade the essays, you have to work very hard as a teacher. Because you have to first grade 100 essays, then label some stuff, do some reinforcement learning, grade another 100, see how the machine does it, compare it, etc. And one of the things that he said, and this is of course also how you do legal intelligence, one of the things that he said is now what we shouldn't do is give over grading to these systems. Teachers should use it to do to have the bulk done. But, of course, they have to always check between pass and fail, and usually the lower part, because that may be actually in the top, it turns out. But he gave a whole set of advices how we can learn as teachers from these machines, because they don't get tired, because they can be more objective in some particular sense. So I'm convinced we're going to live with algorithms. This is going to be all around us, and the sooner we learn how to interact with them, so not just use them and them using our data, but to interact with them, to guess what they're doing and to play around with them like they play around with us, the better. And then the question is, when to use a learning algorithm that may be a bit unpredictable, but more effective, but more difficult to explain? And when to use a dumb algorithm, precisely because you can calculate what it's going to say and you can calculate back. So instead of saying I'm against this or against that, it's when, how. And I think that conversation can only be had together because the domain knowledge has to fit in, and like lawyers and all the other professions have to learn to understand what machine learners are willing to share with us.
I would agree. I really enjoyed hearing everyone's thoughts on this. And I was deliberately being a little provocative, though I do, by in terms of comparing humans to like information processing systems. But I guess that is, in the short term, I would probably concede that all the points that are made hold. But the long term, it's to me, it's not that clear. And one final observation that I would like to make is one thing we might have overlooked is actually there are a lot of algorithms that are being used to explain human decision making as well. Like, in fact, Sarah presented discrimination discovery methods, and if you think about them, all those discrimination discovery algorithms are being run over decisions made by humans to figure out whether there was discrimination and so on. So there is this, I think in the process of focusing on trying to explain machine decision making, we shouldn't forget the equally important role that algorithms have in terms of helping us understand about ourselves, particularly at macroscopic level and our implicit biases and so on.
So we seem to end in full agreement, which was brilliant. So if we could just thank all the panelists for a great session.
Perhaps I'll just expand on that a little bit. Let's thank Neil also. And let's thank all of our speakers also, which includes many of the panelists, but everyone today I think did a great job. And I hope everyone enjoyed these panel discussions. I'm sorry in the end that we didn't end up taking questions from the audience. I think that if anyone has any burning questions, then perhaps if you're happy to stay later, some of our panelists might be happy to try and address some of those. And I'll just end with another nod of thanks to our sponsors. It's the Center for the Study of Existential Risk, Clifford Chance, the Leverhulme Center for the Future of Intelligence, and the Alan Turing Institute. Thanks very much.
And thank you, Adrian Weller.